Chapter 13. A Scream in the Night. When Patrick was not quite a year old, murder came again to our block. Like Mrs. Niedermeyer, the victim was an elderly woman who lived alone. Hers was the first house as she turned onto Churchill Road off Dixie Highway, directly behind the all-night open-air laundromat, and I only knew her to wave to as I passed. The attacker was a stranger who snuck into her house while she was in the backyard hanging her laundry on a Saturday afternoon. When she returned, he bound her wrist with telephone cord and shoved her beneath a mattress as he ransacked the house for money. He fled with his plunder as my frail neighbor slowly suffocated beneath the weight of the mattress. Police quickly arrested a drifter who had been seen hanging around the coin laundry. When they emptied his pockets, they found his total haul had been $16 and change, the price of a human life. The crime swirling around us made us grateful for Marley's bigger-than-life presence in our house. When strangers came to our door, we no longer locked Marley away before answering. We stopped assuring them how harmless he was. We had a baby now, and another on the way. Jenny and I often speculated about just what, if anything, Marley would do if someone ever tried to hurt the baby or us. I tended to think he would merely grow frantic. Jenny placed more faith in him. She was convinced his special loyalty to us, especially to his new Cheerios pusher Patrick, would translate in a crisis to a fierce primal protectiveness that would rise up from deep within him. Then one night, he settled the dispute once and for all. It was October, and the weather still had not turned. The night was sweltering. I was just drifting off when I heard it, a shrill, sustained, piercing noise. I was instantly wide awake, and Marley was too. He stood frozen beside the bed in the dark, ears cocked. It came again, penetrating the sealed windows, rising above the hum of the air conditioner. A woman's scream, loud and unmistakable. There was desperation in it, real terror. And it was dawning on me that someone was in terrible trouble. "Come on, boy." I slipped out of bed. "Don't go out there." I hadn't realized Jenny was awake, too. "Call the police. I'll be careful." Holding Marley by the end of his choker chain, I stepped out onto the front porch in my boxer shorts, just in time to glimpse a figure sprinting down the street toward the water. The scream came again from the opposite direction. Outside, without the walls and glass to buffet it, the woman's voice filled the night air with an amazing, piercing velocity, the likes of which I had heard only in horror movies. Other porch lights were flicking on. The two young men who shared a rental house across the street from me burst outside wearing nothing but cutoffs and ran toward the screams. I followed, Marley tight by my side. I saw them run up on a lawn a few houses away and then, seconds later, come dashing back toward me. "Go to the girl," one of them shouted, pointing. "She's been stabbed." "We're going after him," the other one yelled, and they sprinted off barefoot down the street in the direction the figure had fled. My neighbor Barry, a fearless single woman, jumped into her car and joined the chase. I let go of Marley's collar and ran toward the scream. Three doors down, I found my 17-year-old neighbor standing alone in her driveway, bent over, sobbing in jagged, raspy gasps. She clasped her ribs, and beneath her hands I could see a circle of blood spreading across her blouse. She was a thin, pretty girl with sand-colored hair that fell over her shoulders. She lived in the house with her divorced mother, a pleasant woman who worked as a night nurse. I had chatted a few times with the mother, but I only knew her daughter to wave to. I didn't even know her name. "He said not to scream or he'd stab me," she said, sobbing. Her words gushed out in heaving, hyperventilated gulps. "But I screamed, and he stabbed me." As if I might not believe her, she lifted her shirt to show me the puckered wound that had punctured her ribcage. "I was sitting in my car with the radio on. He just came out of nowhere." I put my hand on her arm to calm her, and as I did, I saw her knees buckling. She collapsed into my arms, her legs folding fawn-like beneath her. I eased her down to the pavement and sat cradling her. Her words came softer, calmer now, and she fought to keep her eyes open. "He told me not to scream," she kept saying. "You did the right thing," I said. "You scared him away." It occurred to me that she was going into shock, and I had not the first idea what to do about it. "Come on, ambulance, where are you?" I comforted her in the only way I knew how, as I would comfort my own child, stroking her hair, holding my palm against her cheek, wiping her tears away. As she grew weaker, I kept telling her to hang on. Help was on the way. "You're going to be okay." I wasn't sure I believed it. Her skin was ashen. We sat alone on the pavement like that for what seemed hours, but was in actuality, the police report later showed, about 3 minutes. Only gradually did I think to check on what had become of Marley. When I looked up, there he stood, 10 feet from us, facing the street, in a determined, bull-like crouch I had never seen before. It was a fighter stance. His muscles bulged at the neck, his jaw was clenched, the fur between his shoulder blades bristled. He was intensely focused on the street and appeared poised to lunge. I realized in that instant that Jenny had been right. If the armed assailant returned, he would have to get past my dog first. At that moment, I absolutely knew, without doubt, that Marley would fight him to the death before he would let him at us. I was emotional anyway as I held this young girl, wondering if she was dying in my arms. The sight of Marley so uncharacteristically guarding us like that, so majestically fierce, brought tears to my eyes. Man's best friend? Damn straight he was. "I've got you," I told the girl. But what I meant to say, what I should have said, was that we had her, Marley and me. "The police are coming. Hold on. Please. Just hold on." Before she closed her eyes, she whispered, "My name is Lisa. I'm John." It seemed ridiculous introducing ourselves in these circumstances as though we were at a neighborhood potluck. I almost laughed. Instead, I tucked a strand of her hair behind her ear and said, "You're safe now, Lisa." Like an archangel sent from heaven, a police officer came charging up the sidewalk. I whistled to Marley and called, "It's okay, boy. He's okay." And it was as if, with that whistle, I had broken some kind of trance. My goofy, good-natured pal was back. Soon an ambulance crew arrived with a stretcher and wads of sterile gauze. I stepped out of the way, told the police what I could, and walked home, Marley loping ahead of me. Jenny met me at the door, and together we stood in the front window watching the drama unfold on the street. You would have been proud of Marley. He felt the danger, and he was like a completely different dog. "I told you so," and she had. It said something about South Florida's numbness to crime that the stabbing of a teenage girl as she sat in her car in front of her home would merit just 6 sentences in the morning newspaper. The story made no mention of me or Marley or the guys across the street who set out half-naked after the assailant. It didn't mention Barry, who gave chase in her car, or all the neighbors up and down the block who turned on porch lights and dialed 911. The knife had punctured Lisa's lung, and she spent 5 days in the hospital and several weeks recuperating at home. Her mother kept the neighbors apprised of her recovery, but the girl remained inside and out of sight. I worried about the emotional wounds the attack might leave. Would she ever again be comfortable leaving the safety of her home? Our lives had come together for just 3 minutes, but I felt invested in her as a brother might be in a kid's sister. Then as I washed the cars in the driveway on a Saturday, Marley chained up beside me, I looked up and there she stood. Prettier than I had remembered, tan, strong, athletic-looking, whole again. She smiled. "Remember me?" Let's see. Weren't you the one in front of me at the Tom Petty concert who wouldn't sit down? She laughed. So how are you doing, Lisa?
I'm good, just about back to normal.
You look great, a little better than the last time I saw you.
Yeah, well,
what a night. What a night, I repeated.
That was all we said about it. She told me about the hospital, the doctors, the detectives who interviewed her, the endless fruit baskets, the boredom of sitting at home as she healed. But she steered clear of the attack, and so did I. Some things were best left behind.
Lisa stayed a long time that afternoon, following me around the yard as I did chores, playing with Marley, making small talk. I sensed there was something she wanted to say but could not bring herself to. She was 17. I didn't expect her to find the words. Our lives had collided without plan or warning. In a heartbeat, there we were, intimately locked together in crisis, a dad in boxer shorts and a teenage girl in a blood-soaked blouse, clinging to each other and to hope. There was a closeness there now. How could there not be? There was also awkwardness, a slight embarrassment, for in that moment we had caught each other with our guards down. We had shared something that night on the pavement, one of those brief, fleeting moments of clarity that define all the others in a life that neither of us would soon forget. By the time she left, I had a good feeling about this girl. She was strong, she would move forward, and indeed, I found out years later, when I learned she had built a career for herself as a television broadcaster, that she had.